Hello, Internet! Welcome to episode 45 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful hostess, Aaron Paulette. How are you doing, Aaron?
Well, Weird, I understand that since this is the 45th episode, you have kind of a hankering to make this episode 45 minutes, and I'll see what I can do to make that happen by not being so freaking entertaining.
Whether it's not. I've always joked that if we have an episode that is 45 minutes long, or approximately 45 minutes long, I'm going to call it 45 ACP. I don't think that's going to happen because we've got stuff to talk about. We've got lots of good segments. But guess what? It's episode 45 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. That makes it 45 ACP, my favorite caliber.
So shall we just jump right into the topic?
Sure. Why not? So I wanted to. This came up a little while ago, and there's a couple of things that tie into it. But our lovely friend Xander, hi Xander, posted this in the ACP Facebook group, and it is about police abuse of seized guns. And it talks about one of the key stories, which is, it's a tough story. Is a man that had an unloaded black powder pistol in his, I believe it was in his carry-on luggage. And the TSA had problems with this, but he pointed out the fact that it's unloaded and it was not a firearm. By ATF definitions, so therefore should not be contraband. It might've been in his regular baggage.
It was an antique. That's important.
Yes. Yeah. It was an antique cap and ball revolver. So it was manufactured before 1900. And so therefore, these are the type of guns that, like, if you won in an auction an original Smith & Wesson Schofield or a Walker Colt revolver, you could just have them shipped to your door. No background check needed, no nothing, because it's that old. I've got a 19th century Mosin Nagant, and that's not a gun. According to the ATF laws. And so, it ended up going to court. The guy successfully argued that, no, I'm not breaking any rules because it's not loaded, which would be a problem. And it's not a gun by definition of the law. So therefore, all of the complaints that they had and why they seized it were that. And they went, oh, we already destroyed it, which, ugh.
Yeah. And so this is what the article is about. There's just this pattern of abuse where these seized firearms are being destroyed before the owners can claim them.
Mm-hmm.
And this really... Okay, first of all, I'm just tired of all the awful things that are happening regarding the Second Amendment. So this is just kind of getting me down. There's no kind about it. This bothers me. And then there's just the added injustice of, the guy did nothing wrong. He argued the case. He spent the time and the effort and the money on a court case. He was proven to be in the right, but, too late. We destroyed it anyway. We destroyed your antique. Tough shit. What are you going to do about it?
And again, these departments are just so horny to destroy the guns. Like, they just want to destroy a gun so bad that, yeah, they're just destroying a gun that's, no, the court hasn't ruled yet. Hold your horses. Wait on it. Yeah, the court orders you to the gun be returned. Oh, well, about that gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, never mind the other abuse that gets talked about on the guns that get lost, whether they get actually lost or get put in the wrong place. There's certainly been cases where, yeah, they've opened up an evidence locker somewhere and there's a gun in here. There wasn't supposed to be a gun in here. Where's this gun? Oh, there's this gun. Sometimes it even gets back to maybe the original owner. I don't know. Not in Massachusetts. But there's also times when, it gets put in the wrong evidence locker. And the next thing you know, geez, that custom 1911 that got seized is in Officer Friendly, who happens to be a gun nut and appreciates fine 1911's gun safe at home.
And the problem here is that this is not an isolated event. They're actually under internal affairs investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And they have found So this is happening in the Massachusetts State Police. And they have found at least 18, well, they say 18 barracks. And I guess a barracks is the state police version of a precinct, maybe. I don't know. But 18 of these units is having sloppy and inaccurate record handling, record keeping, specifically with regards to confiscated guns, drugs, and money. Look, if these were not employees of the government, they would be in jail.
Yep.
And they're not.
Yeah, let's talk to all of our friends that that run our friendly neighborhood gun shops and ask, oh, yeah, what would happen if, your paperwork was all over the place and you had guns that weren't in your inventory that you said were in your inventory and guns that you said that were in your inventory that you couldn't produce? You might find yourself either under heavy fines or looking for a new line of work.
And, you know, normally this would be the cherry on top of the sundae, but I'm just too angry to laugh about it. It's just deeply ironic to me that the state police troop that is responsible for Logan Airport, which is where the black powder pistol happened, they are known as Troop F.
Mm-hmm.
F Troop.
They are the F Troop.
F Troop is in charge of Logan Airport.
Yeah, that joke gets thrown around a lot here.
If it weren't so sad, it would be funny.
Well, to tie it in a little bit further, it was the last week we talked about the fiasco with Benchmade and how, well, for the last couple of weeks, really, we've been talking about the fiasco. No, just last week. I'm getting confused on the all the different angles that I've been hearing people talking about the whole Benchmade destroying firearms.
Well, actually, you are correct, because the first time we talked about it was in the mag dump that we recorded the previous
week.
That's
right.
Yeah, from your perspective, you talked about it for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. From the listener's perspective, we talked about it the same week.
Yes, but
wibbly wobbly, timey wimey ball of stuff.
There is. I've got a link to a Liberty Doll. Well, we love you, Liberty Doll. And she actually has some evidence. It's not conclusive in any way, shape, or form, but there's certainly evidence indicative that says that the guns that were being destroyed by Benchmade may have in fact been red flag guns. It's certainly in the press release from the police, they go out of their way to make it to make note that these guns were not crime guns, were not guns that were voluntarily surrendered. And so she's got evidence pointed. She's got a whole bunch of links in her show notes. So dive right through on that. But that these very possibly could have been red flag guns, which I would say, especially also seeing the F Troop behavior, that where, again, these anti-gun departments are just so excited about destroying a gun, about taking a gun off the street, that even when somebody has a red flag law, you know, called out on them, again, the whole point on the red playing devil's advocate for the anti-gunners, the whole point of the devil's red flag laws is that, oh, we're going to take care of the guns first and then figure out the situation. So it's not a permanent, you're not permanently losing your guns. You are losing your guns until we can figure out what's happening. And
unless, of course, the police get jumpy and decide to destroy them just for the thrill of destroying guns. And okay, it's wasteful. Why? I mean, I understand that there are most, if not all, police departments are constantly scratching for more money.
Mm-hmm.
Guns have inherent value. Unless they are completely non-functional, you know, I'll even get the whole used in a terrible crime. Like, you know, someone might fetishize the gun that was used in the Parkland shooting, so I can at least sort of understand the reasoning for destroying it. But just something that was seized, for crying out loud, sell it at auction so that the police get value from it.
Mm-hmm. It's destruction of wealth. These are precision made machines, and someone took a lot of time, lots of someone's took time to make most of them, and just to destroy them, it's superstition, really. It's the only thing that just keeps coming into my mind, is that somehow the gun is inherently evil. And I mean, we see a lot of this in the culture, specifically the anti-gun culture, where you read news reports about a shooting and everything's written in passive voice, like it's the gun doing the shooting.
There's an actual specific term for that. Mm-hmm. It's called a deodand.
Yes.
And a deodand is a thing forfeited or given to God. And specifically in law, it is an object that becomes instrumented because it has caused a person's death. And it goes back to English common law, like the 10th or 11th century. I mean, it goes way far back, and it's superstitious. And the idea is this thing has caused the death of a person. Well, actually, I think it refers to murder. It might not refer to, like, a weapon of war. But, you know, this has committed sin, therefore it must be destroyed because there is some sort of curse upon it. Possessing it might cause the owner to do more evil. And so, yes, we superstitiously destroy it.
Mm-hmm. I'm furiously typing right now, trying to find, but I remember one of the last deodand cases was actually a steam locomotive was destroyed because someone was killed. And it's just, that story just strikes me as hilarious on both something that is so, so valuable and useful, and even more so back then, during the golden age of rail, and yet, and also just destroying something like that because, you bad, bad locomotive for running someone down. So let's talk about something different.
Okay, great. I'm glad you said that because I want to leaven this awful with something light and happy-making. I would like to congratulate the state of Oklahoma for becoming the most recent and actually the 15th state to pass constitutional carry. So good on them. And this is unrestricted constitutional carry. There are some states like Idaho, North Dakota, Wyoming, only residents can carry constitutionally. Other visitors have to have a permit. But Oklahoma, like Kansas next to it, is just complete constitutional carry, and it's wonderful. And I don't know how long it'll be before half of the states are constitutional carry, but I've noticed that this is happening with increasing frequency. And with each victory, we are shifting that Overton window and we are normalizing permitless carry by responsible, law-abiding citizens.
Yeah, no, it's really a good statement. And again, the proof is in the pudding, is that these states that are enacting it, like when... Obviously, we've got Alaska and Vermont, which let's just say don't count because they had been, I mean, Vermont never required a permit whatsoever. So back in the days when Thomas Jefferson would step out onto his property and stuff a pistol into his belt as he was going about his day, that was the law in Vermont, and Vermont never felt the need to change it. If you can legally own a gun, why wouldn't you carry it? There's as actually a police officer in the city of Belmont, Massachusetts, said to me, I'm not going to give his name because he might get in trouble for it. But he goes, I don't agree why we're not giving you a permit, because this was my second time that a person first meeting me was telling me that I was not going to be able to carry a firearm in that town. Said, I don't agree with that. I mean, you've got guns. I assume you've got lots of guns. There's nothing to stop you from carrying them. Just mm-hmm. So what are we doing here? And again, I've got lots of guns, and I've got lots of guns legally, and I'm in the police station. So clearly I'm not concerned about such things. So the whole playing mother may I is foolish. But then on top of that, when Arizona was like the first modern state to get constitutional carry, and a lot of people, I mean, myself included, I actually remember Sebastian, I think it was still Snowflakes in Hell then, but now he's PA Gunblog, was talking about I have good feelings about this, but at the same time, Arizona's got some, major U.S. cities within its borders. Before that, it was Alaska and Vermont, which are wonderful, beautiful states that have mostly nothing. They're very low population density. And as we all know, the population density is where the violent crime is. It has nothing to do with the guns. And so people were worried about, you know, Arizona. It's got Phoenix. It's got Flagstaff. It's got, I'm probably missing a few other major cities in Arizona. I'm sorry. I'm not super familiar. But yeah, it's got some major cities. Maybe Arizona might see a rise in violent crime because of constitutional carry. And it didn't. And then I can't remember who the next one was, but another state dipped in and another state dipped in. And now at this point in time, it's understood, like, yes, Oklahoma is not going to see a rise in violent crime. They're going to be just fine of people not having to have carry permits. So, yeah, that's such good news.
I'm going to make a prediction here because here's what I know about Oklahoma and Texas. Texans have this intense rivalry with Oklahoma, and they hate it when Oklahoma has things they don't. And Oklahoma first passed open carry in 2016, and you know you had to have a permit, but you could openly carry. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry, I don't remember when Oklahoma passed it, but in 2016, Texas finally got it, and it was only after Oklahoma did it. Yep. And I think a lot of that was, how come them Okies got it and we don't?
Yep.
Because really, that is the way to motivate Texans. And now that Oklahoma has constitutional carry, now I'm not saying it'll be next, I'm not saying it'll be soon, but this is the kick in the pants, and it'll happen. And I think that is going to be the major change when a big, big state like Texas, and it's one of the four or five states that really matter in presidential elections because the population density, it's like New York, California, and I don't know the order. And then I think it's like Texas and I think it might be Illinois because of Chicago, and then Texas and then Florida. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't had a major electoral college state going open carry, and now Texas has that incentive. And when that happens, that's going to be impressive.
Yeah. And I will also say I've seen a very similar thing like that, is that New Hampshire has always been a ridiculously gun-friendly state. And even way back in the, you know, the days of concealed carry being illegal, New Hampshire literally just had a absolute basic mother may I carry permit system. You would walk into your police station, you would fill out one sheet of paper. You would give it to the police officer. They would literally just run a background check on you. And within the week, you would get a permit. I was actually surprised when I got my New Hampshire permit. Like, I had to look up everywhere. And I'm like, I think I sent a photograph with it and they threw it away because they don't even, you don't even have a photograph on your New Hampshire permit.
same with Indiana, I think.
Yeah. And yeah, JG referred to the New Hampshire permit as "why bother," and there was always constitutional carry laws going through New Hampshire. There's a lot of very, very pro-gun people in New Hampshire, and so yeah, there flow all sorts of pro-gun bills all the time, and they always seem to get shot down. They never seem to get that much attention, and then Maine got constitutional carry, so that meant every state that shares a border with New Hampshire either had constitutional carry or was Massachusetts.
Ouch.
And trust me, yeah, your gut reaction, New Hampshire feels the exact same way about Massachusetts as you think. So it was literally the next legislative session. Ta-da, mm-hmm. Constitutional carry from New Hampshire. Awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I just looked this up because I hate it when I get dates wrong. Okay, so open carry with permit in Oklahoma, 2012. Open carry with permit in Texas, 2016. 4 years, mm-hmm. or basically the tenure of a governor.
Yep.
And so I'm thinking before around about 2024, I'm going to look forward to Texas becoming constitutional carry. Texans, make this happen. You're gonna disappoint me if you don't.
Yeah. And make it the good kind where yeah, just anyone can come through, because I mean, Texas is already pretty good. Like, when I carry in Texas, I like when we were in Dallas, I was carrying on my Massachusetts permit. That doesn't happen anywhere. Well, except for Indiana. I'll be carrying on my Massachusetts permit in Indiana.
So, hey, Weird, how do anti-gunners like to argue?
They like to argue in bad faith.
And how do we know this?
Because they do it all the time.
That's right. And if you needed more proof of that, check out this audio fisk where Weird takes Dr. Jeff Swanson to task. Wait for the part where Weird essentially says, "Stop hitting yourself."
So for this week's Weird Audio Fisk, I have Dr. Jeffrey Swanson from Duke University. Dr. Swanson is a professor of psychology and also a total nut who believes that guns cause violence.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Jeff Swanson from the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences here at Duke University School of Medicine, and I'm here to talk to you today about gun violence in America, our nation's ungodly affliction that claims the lives of 35,000 people every single year, 90 or 100 every day. That's the drip, 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 drip of firearm-related injury and mortality in our country.
Of course, we know the bulk of these deaths are suicide, and Dr. Swanson's going to talk about that. Still, the biggest thing that anti-gunners never talk about is how this number is more or less a constant value in the United States. Back in the 80s, when concealed carry was mostly illegal, cops and civilians still carried revolvers, and rifles that held more than 8 rounds were uncommon, it was still about 3,500. During the federal assault weapons ban, about 3,500. After the law was allowed to sunset, about 3,500. Really, the only change to these numbers is the number of homicides versus the number of suicides. Currently, we are in record low homicide numbers. I would argue that is thanks to the rollback of many restrictions on private gun ownership and the rise in the popularity of concealed carry and constitutional carry. And we are sadly experiencing very high suicide numbers, which I suspect has to do with the fact that we are in the longest period of war in U.S. history, with far more returning and often injured soldiers than we have infrastructure to help. So if these numbers have been virtually constant no matter what the gun laws, why concern ourselves with the gun laws? Yeah, that's why the anti-gunners never talk about this.
On another awful day in America, and we feel sad, we feel discouraged, we feel angry for a few days, and then we kind of go on and we think maybe this is just the new normal. There's nothing we can do about it.
I will note that this video was released shortly after the Parkland shooting. Remember that? Of course you do, because they talked about it for months. Then Michael Bloomberg organized the March for Our Lives rally that was held in major cities across the country, and the national news was covering it nonstop. But what was the political end result of this? Nothing, except for a few feel-good laws in Florida. Maybe that's why antis claim we don't react to mass shootings. Oh, and at no point did the media or any of these anti-gun groups pay any attention to the incompetence on behalf of law enforcement leading up to the shooting at Parkland.
We love guns in this country, and we have a heck of a lot of them. And more people now own guns for personal protection. Some of us think that if we had more guns and more places and hands of more people, we might be safer.
Yeah, well, the Parkland shooting was in a gun-free zone. And it was so deadly because responding officers, as in the only good guys with guns, elected to hide outside rather than confront the shooter. Pulse nightclub was in a gun-free zone. Sandy Hook was a gun-free zone. I could go on, but the vast bulk of spree killings happen in gun-free zones. And when some nut decides to shoot up a bunch of strangers in an area where concealed carry is allowed, frequently that event does not become a mass shooting. So yeah, I think we have good reason to both love and want guns.
The scientific evidence doesn't bear that out, but people act on the basis of what they believe to be true.
Except it does. Check the show notes. Heck, check reality. The anti-gunners claim there are huge numbers of mass shootings in the United States. But even when there's a relatively minor shooting, it's national news. And think of every spree killing that has made the news. How many of them were places that didn't allow guns? Many cases, the killer even told us that they were concerned about return fire. This is just reality Dr. Swanson doesn't like.
And the rest of us just sometimes throw up our hands and we think, maybe there's nothing that we can do.
Except maybe end gun-free zones and stop may-issue carry permit systems? Maybe punish law enforcement officers who disobey department policy on active shooters and refuse to clear a school, allowing more victims to be shot and the wounded to succumb. That might be a start.
It's a tough problem. There's not one thing. People ask me, well, what's the one thing you should do? And there's not a one thing problem. There are a lot of things we should do, and there are things we can do. But maybe we could come together and say, let's start here. Do we agree that someone at manifestly high risk of doing something really harmful, violent to another person or to himself or herself, that person, if we knew that, at that moment, should not have legal access to a firearm?
Well, I think we could agree with that. Now, what we can agree with is how to predict who is a danger and who isn't. I have a quote for you. Can we reliably predict violence? No, is the short answer. Psychiatrists, using clinical judgment, are not much better than chance at predicting which individual patients will do something violent and which will not. You can profile the perpetrators after the fact, and you'll get a description of troubled young men, which also matches the description of thousands of other troubled young men who would never do something like this. You know who said that? Dr. Jeffrey Swanson, PhD. So yeah, the rest of this, Fisk, just remember, Dr. Swanson is now being completely dishonest.
People out there in America believe that we should limit legal access to guns from someone who's dangerous, and we should give police officers that authority, and we should give family members a tool to initiate at least temporary removal of firearms from people in situations like that.
Yep, he's talking about red flag laws. I've been very open that I find these laws to be very scary. But they're even scarier when they're being pushed by a professor of psychology who, in his expert opinion, believes that there is no way to clinically predict violence in mentally ill patients.
Gun owners support this. That is, you don't wait until someone's committed a crime and now, you know, they're a person prohibited from firearms and they can't go buy one from a federally licensed dealer. You remove the guns first when there's probable cause to believe that there's imminent risk.
Gun owners support this? This is the same crap we've seen with universal background checks. There were surveys that allegedly said gun owners were all for universal background checks, and then they put it to a vote, and the numbers just haven't been there, time and time again. So pardon me if I may sound skeptical. And we're talking red flag laws, which by nature are against due process. Somebody claims that you're an extreme risk, and note, even Dr. Swanson admits that this is just wild speculation, the authorities then can swoop in and take your guns. And then you get to prove you are innocent to the courts, as in the exact opposite of due process of law. Also note that even if there were amazing breakthrough in clinical science, and we could determine who is a risk and who wasn't, the law still takes the guns and leaves the violent person alone. Go to the show notes. I have a link to my blog of a fake Navy SEAL who was profiled by Don Shipley of Extreme SEAL Experience. The guy was lying about his military service and making threats to people, which shows his mental state. He was such a nuisance that Shipley had a restraining order against him, which he violated and was jailed for it. The story goes strange when you hear that this guy met his end just days after being released from jail by crashing his personal airplane into a swamp near a golf course. The guy was a convicted felon and the subject of a restraining order, but he could totally still fly an airplane. Never mind drive a car which kills far more people than guns. This is how dumb these laws are. Okay, I'm running long. I'll tackle the rest of this nonsense next week. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Oh, I do so love it when you can use your opponent's words against him. That destroyed his argument right there.
Yeah, I gotta say, I do love the little bait and switch that I pulled on with that. I just got a quote for you. Let me just say that. You know who said that? This guy. I'll be quoting it again next week just because it's too valuable of a quote not to use again, but you'll already have heard it, so I'm just gonna throw it out there. But oh God. Like, he's just constantly talking about, it's just all bad faith arguments. That's the best way to explain it, is he's just appealing to his own authority and just lying to our faces to push his agenda. So if you browse through various knife retailers, you've definitely seen them. Those strange curved blades with that ring on the end of the handle. Are they the best knife ever or a gimmick beloved to those knife hipsters? Oddball will answer all your questions on the Karambit.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. The other night I was talking to some friends, and one of them asked me about Karambits. He knew I was into martial arts and a knife geek, so he was interested in my thoughts. I thought this might make an interesting segment, so let's get into it. Oh, and word of warning, I am going to talk about some stuff that might upset more squeamish folks out there. I'll try to stay clinical about it, but using a knife in a fight is just not pretty. If you're unfamiliar with the Karambit, it's an unusual knife most often associated with the Philippines. The knife's hawkbill blade resembles a cat's claw, with the edge on the inside of the curve. Although there are some examples, both modern and historical, that are also sharp on the outside of the curve. There's a ring at the base of the handle for either your pinky or index finger, depending on whether you're holding it tip up or tip down. In the past few years, this style of knife has become popular in certain circles. Of course, this has meant that there are some people that claim that this is the greatest knife design ever, and other folks that claim that it's purely tactical, gimmicky junk. While it's a fairly new tool in the Western tactical circles, it's something that the Filipino martial arts has incorporated for a long, long time. One of the arts that I study is a Filipino art, which means that, while I am not a master of this particular weapon, I have played with it, and I have an idea of what it can and cannot do. So the question is, do I think that this weapon is a worthy self-defense tool, or something that should be regulated to that of the Mall Ninja crowd? Unfortunately, the answer, as with many things, is, well, yes and no. There's a meme that has floated around the internet for a while, entitled, "What Your Sword Says About You." Under the katana, it says, quote, "I either have no idea what I'm doing, or every idea what I'm doing." That's kind of how I feel about the Karambit. Using a Karambit isn't like using a more standard knife. That curved blade means that the point is off-center for most stabbing techniques, and is honestly not particularly great for stabbing. A double-bladed Karambit helps with that issue, but it pretty much eliminates folding designs, and even most fixed blades are only sharpened on the inside of the curve. Unfortunately, most modern knife fighting schools of thought consider the stab to be the most effective strike. Slashes with most fighting knives will typically leave shallow cuts, and it's amazing how much loose clothing, like a sweatshirt or jacket, will actually protect the target. While these cuts will definitely bleed, and can lead to the target bleeding out, they may not do anything other than annoy the target until that happens. A stab, on the other hand, will penetrate deeper for obvious reasons. This means that there's a greater chance of hitting something vital and therefore ending the fight right there. Either way, as you can tell, knife fights are nasty, messy affairs. What the Karambit does excel in is maximizing cutting and slashing damage. That curved blade means that the tip of the knife is pretty much guaranteed to dig into the target. That means that the knife will really tend to cut into the target instead of just skating across the top. These deeper wounds have a higher chance of getting into muscle tissue, arteries, tendons, etc., which could cause the end of the threat. As a side note, this tendency has also caused many carpet and vinyl knives to use the hawkbill blade profile. In fact, a hawkbill blade is my favorite style for opening boxes. The ring at the end of the handle is designed simply to help you hold onto the knife. With your fingers slipped through that ring, it's practically impossible to drop the knife. This can be important if your hands get slick because they are wet, or if someone is trying to take your knife, say, because you're in a knife fight. While I have seen extra material extending past the ring, up to and including a spike or second blade, so that you can use it as a second striking point, most examples just end with a simple ring. These changes from what most think of a, quote, traditional fighting knife, is what causes it to be controversial. If you try to use a Karambit in the same manner as, say, a straight dagger, you will be highly disappointed, and will determine that it's a bad design. But it really wasn't designed to be used that way. While the blade profile is generally referred to by the knife world as a hawkbill, I like to think of it more of a cat's claw. Incidentally, I'm not the only one. Legend has it that the knife design was inspired by a tiger's claw. Anyone that has owned a cat can tell you that those claws are great at grabbing and tearing just about anything, such as your skin, clothes, or those nice curtains your wife bought. This is how you should treat this knife. Instead of thinking of it as a knife, I like to think of it as a substitution for my hand when grappling, or the empty hand strikes that are taught in Kali. When it is treated like that, this knife can be used to terrifying effect. The final question is probably, do I carry one? At the moment, I don't. This is not because I don't think that it's a bad knife for defense. The problem is twofold. First, I already have a bunch of crap on my belt and in my pockets. As much as I love the Karambit design, that curved blade and finger ring means that it's bulky. Other blade designs make for more sleek packages, well, either in sheaths or folded. The other reason is that I just haven't found an example that I like that I'm willing to pay for. I know this might shock Aaron, but there are a significant number of knives out there that are priced somewhere between, I don't know if I want to drop that kind of cash on a knife, to, does this knife come with sexual favors in my book? Unfortunately, it seems like there's a lot of Karambits at the gas station POS price point, and a number of them that are in the price ranges beyond what I'm willing to pay, but not a whole lot in the middle. This seems to be changing some, and there are a couple that I may drop the cash on. Currently, the best folding Karambit that I have in my collection is made by Taylor Brands under the Smith & Wesson Extreme Ops brand. While I like the design itself, its blade is made out of 7CR17 MOV, which is just a little bit too soft in my opinion. If you do decide to carry a Karambit, or any knife for that matter, for self-defense, I highly recommend that you get training based around that style of knife. The reason why people switched to firearms over edged weapons in war is because it's easier to kill the enemy with a gun than it is with a knife, and it's much easier to kill that enemy without him hurting or killing you in the process. This translates pretty well into self-defense situations as well. It's fairly common for the, quote, winner of a knife fight to be the guy that walked a couple of blocks and then fell down dead of blood loss. Folks that study knife fighting will quickly tell you that getting involved in a knife fight pretty much means that you will be cut. It's just a question of how badly. I hope that helps, and if you want to learn more about the use of a Karambit, I highly recommend looking up Doug Markaita's videos on YouTube. As always, if you would like to read more of my work, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future segments, feel free to email me at oddball@gunscarstech.com or give me a shout on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
You know, I really think we should name this segment, if not, maybe even the episode, The Karambit Gambit.
What is your feeling on Karambits, Aaron?
I think they look cool as hell, and I definitely like that hawkbill for cutting things. If I have to get meat off the bone, I really, really like that. But I've not used a Karambit because it looks awkward, and hearing Oddball say that has just reinforced the confidence in my decision not to carry one. Because several years back, I was looking for a fixed blade knife to carry on my belt when I carried my concealed pistol. Because, well, it's not common, but there are times people will see that you have a gun and try to take it off of you. And while you're wrestling for the gun with one hand, you need a way to discourage them with another. And I looked at the Karambit because it looked like what I wanted, and it was explained to me by several people that, no, you don't want it for pretty close to the reasons Oddball mentioned. What I went with was the K-Bar TDI, mm-hmm. which has most of the features of the Karambit that I like, but it doesn't have the drawbacks. It's got a nice long blade. It's got a teardrop shape. It's got a much longer cutting surface. Now, there are two types of the K-Bar TDI. There's the original one, which has a blade 2.31 inches and has an overall length of 5.6 inches. It's just a little bit too small for me. Even though I'm a small person, I don't know. I just like having the much longer blade and the much longer handle for control. So I prefer the large TDI with a blade length of close to 3.7 inches and an overall length of 7.5. And there's really not a whole lot of price difference between the two. I mean, looking at the price on the K-Bar website, it's like $12 difference. Mm-hmm. And I've have both. I've used both to cut things, not in combat or whatever. I really prefer just the confidence the extra length gives me.
Yep. No, I love them. And that was actually one thing I want to tell you. Like, I've got a... I picked it up at like a knife warehouse, and it's a decent quality. It's just a very, very stripped down karambit. It's just the one of those ones where I guess you're supposed to wrap it with paracord or something like that. But one thing I like about the karambit is they feel really good in your hand. And I got to say, it doesn't need anything. It's just the simple blade, tang, ring, all one piece unit karambit with a 2-inch some blade, very, very similar to the original TDI in blade size. But gosh, that handle is just gigantic. I mean, the knife is big as far as how much knife you have to carry on your belt for just that little teeny tiny blade. And I gotta say, that's what keeps me from using it regularly. I also put a link in the show notes for Columbia River Knife and Tool, CRKT. I love them. They came out with this knife called the Provoke, and it's a folding karambit, I guess. You may have to look it up on YouTube. Actually, they've got a YouTube video here on the website. But the action on this thing is really, really cool on how it deploys and how it folds up. But then at the same time, let's see, what's the blade like? It's a 2.4 inch blade. So it's not even a 2.5 inch blade. And yet the knife is gigantic. And it's one of those, like, for that amount of real estate, like, I could carry like a 4 inch conventional blade. And that's just, it really kind of starts souring the deal. So
there's also the fact that it costs $200.
Yes. Yeah, I didn't even know what the price was on it. I actually just saw the price looking at that thing, and I'm like, $200? I ain't got no time for that. Gosh, the $60 knife I carry on that's my extravagant knife.
Yeah, just go to Amazon. Seriously, you can get a regular TDI for like $33 and the large for like $45-something. You know? It's actually lower than MSRP. Just get one of those. You'll be happy. Trust me.
Yeah, buy them a few. Keep them for stocking stuffers.
Wow. I need to hang up my stocking at your house. You're generous.
Absolutely, Aaron.
Last week, David talked about malfunctions, or MALFs, as the cool kids say, caused by ammunition. This week, he continues in that line of thought, detailing the kind of MALFs that are caused by mechanical issues with the firearm itself.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In a recent podcast, Weird mentioned his trip to Florida and returning to winter in the Northeast. This brought to mind a somewhat similar story. A few years ago, when we still lived in upstate New York, my wife and I went to visit my father in Florida one March. Near the end of our visit, a significant winter storm blanketed the Northeast, to the point that on our planned day of departure, we could have gotten to Atlanta, but all of the airports near Albany would have been shut down. So we had to reschedule our return trip, which meant we had to stay in Florida a few more days. Aww. Which caused my wife to have me take pictures of her on the beach and in front of palm trees so she could post them on Facebook for our New York friends. This caused one friend to threaten to plow our driveway into the point it wouldn't be clear until Memorial Day. Also, regarding what happened with LibertyCon, the tickets for this year's convention sold out in around 6 hours. Some of the con committee members didn't even get tickets. As Aaron said, the original hosting hotel is going through renovations that were supposed to be completed before the convention. That's not going to schedule. The LibertyCon committee handled this as well as anyone could have hoped. By the middle of the day after they found out, the con committee had a new date, a new venue, and got the word out to everyone they could. My wife and I had made reservations at the hosting hotel prior to and separately from the convention block. When all this happened, we weren't sure we could cancel our reservations and might have been making a trip to Chattanooga at the end of May anyway. Luckily, it all worked out for us. Not so much for other people, and, like Aaron, I'm also not going to get to meet some online friends this year. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program. In this segment, I'm going to continue my discussion on malfunctions. In the previous segment, I talked about issues caused primarily by ammunition. While the following malfunctions may be due to problems with the ammunition, they are also caused by an issue with the firearm itself. The causes can generally be broken down into spring-related, magazine-related, and maintenance-related. There may also be some overlap between these causes, of course. The main firearm-related malfunctions I'll be discussing today can be organized into failure to feed, double feed, stovepipe, bolt over base, and base over bolt. A failure to feed is just that. The action cycles, but a new round is not fed into the chamber. The most common cause for this is the magazine not being fully seated in the gun. Give the base of the magazine a good whack with your hand, rack the slide, and assess the situation. This is, as you might have guessed, known as the tap-rack-assess procedure. The other causes of this feature are generally spring-related. If the recoil spring is too weak, the slide, or bolt, may be reciprocating too fast for the magazine to lift a cartridge into the feed path. Conversely, if the recoil spring is too strong, it may not allow the slide or bolt to move back far enough to clear the magazine feed lips. Also, if the magazine spring is too weak, it may not be able to lift the stack of cartridges fast enough in the operating cycle. And finally, if the magazine spring is too strong, it may introduce too much friction between the cartridge and the magazine feed lips. Although this last issue will often present itself as more than just a failure to feed. If this problem persists, the easiest test is to try another magazine, preferably one that is known to function properly. Next is the double feed. A double feed occurs when the empty case in the chamber is not extracted and a new loaded round attempts to feed into the chamber anyway, tying up the gun. The most likely causes of this type of malfunction are either the extractor or extractor spring are worn, or the chamber is dirty and is causing the case to stick during extraction. The common solution is to lock the slide or bolt back, remove the magazine, work the action a few times to see if it successfully extracts the case. If this doesn't work, then your handy range rod can be used to drive the stuck case out of the chamber. Note, do not use a cleaning rod. If this issue persists after a good cleaning, look to your extractor. If that's not the cause either, you may have a burr or scratch in the chamber that needs to be addressed. A stovepipe malfunction is when the case is extracted from the chamber but doesn't clear the ejection port before the action closes, leaving the open mouth of the case sticking out of the ejection port, much like a stovepipe sticking out of a cabin roof. Hence the name. It has some similar causes as the double feed I mentioned earlier. The extractor or extractor spring are worn or the chamber is dirty and is causing the case to stick during extraction. In addition, there may be an issue with the ejector not contacting the case with sufficient force to kick it out of the gun. Resolution is even simpler than the double feed. Use the tap rack assess method I mentioned for a failure to feed earlier. One more thing about the stovepipe, this can also be an operator error. If the shooter is not holding the gun firmly enough, the gun can rotate under recoil, robbing the action of some of the energy it needs to eject and chamber a new round. The bolt-over-base malfunction is primarily seen in semi-automatic rifles and occurs when the bolt catches the cartridge partway out of the magazine but not yet lined up with the chamber. The result is the cartridge case gets pinned between the bolt face and the chamber, often with damage to the case. This is usually a magazine spring or feed lips issue, but it can also be caused by a cycle time that's too fast, commonly seen in gas-operated rifles with too much gas pressure. The solution is similar to that of the double feed. Lock the bolt back, remove the magazine. If the round doesn't fall out on its own, use a non-marring tool to dislodge it from the feed ramp. If this issue persists, try using a known good magazine. If the problem stops, try replacing the magazine spring in the one that caused the bolt over base malfunction. If that doesn't work, the feed lips are probably worn or bent, and you should discard that magazine. Last but not least is the very unusual base over bolt malfunction. As with the previous issue, this is also usually found in semi-automatic rifles, and is also generally due to problems with the magazine feed lips. In this feed malfunction, the base of the cartridge case, when released from the magazine, rises above the bolt and is pinned between the top of the bolt face and the chamber. In AR-type rifles, the case head is often wedged in the charging handle relief, making resolving this even more challenging. There are two ways to resolve this issue. The first involves at least three hands and a pair of needle-nose pliers. With this method, one person pulls back on the charging handle to relieve bolt pressure on the cartridge, while the other person uses the pliers to gently coax the case over the top of the bolt and out the ejection port. The second method only works on AR-type rifles and involves pushing out both the rear takedown pin and the front hinge pin, then gently working the upper receiver off the lower. This is complicated by the tail of the bolt carrier being partially in the receiver extension. Once the receiver halves are separated, the charging handle and bolt are easier to slide back and the case is easier to access through the bottom of the upper receiver. Obviously, these are not the only malfunctions you're likely to encounter on the range, but this segment and the previous one should cover most of the ammunition and firearm-related issues you'll see. I've asked our host to put some reference links in the show notes. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
So, Aaron, I gotta ask, your mom has a Kel-Tec PMR-30.
Correct.
Has she ever experienced stovepipe, or you experienced stovepipe pipe jams with that gun?
Let me think. No, I don't believe I have. I know that when I first started shooting it, I was experiencing some keyholing, and that may have been the ammunition. And I do know that there's one magazine that started to get a little bit finicky, and it would load the first 20 rounds well, and then about the 21st, 23rd round, it was like, no, we're tired. We don't want to do this anymore. And so that magazine has been relegated to practice at the range. But I don't remember any stovepiping issues.
Yeah, I was just asking because that I was thinking about the fact that when I think of stovepipes, like the stovepipe-o-matic gun is the Desert Eagle. And actually, interestingly enough, on Car's own YouTube page, they've got a slow motion video of somebody shooting a Desert Eagle. And you see in the slow motion video, that gun almost stovepipes. And the reason for it is because if you ever racked the slide on a Desert Eagle, you know that action goes back for like a mile and a half. Like the gun like nearly doubles in length when the slide locks back. Just because...
Yeah.
You're dealing with those magnum rounds in it. They just they're huge. They're long rounds, and so they take up a lot more space than say what would normally be a long round of a 45 ACP or a 10 millimeter. No, these are 44 magnum or 50 action express is way longer.
Yeah, racking a Deagle definitely counts as arm day.
Yes. But yeah, I've had him stovepipe on me, even holding it. I mean, just heavy recoil and a long action like that is just begging for a stovepipe jam. And I know that the Kel-Tecs, they just sit right still. I mean, I love the PMR-30. That's just a cool gun, but it does have a relatively long action with that 22 Winchester Magnum. So I was wondering if it ever experienced a stovepipe jam.
Well, not in my experience, but then I haven't shot it a whole lot. It is my mom's carry piece, and unfortunately she hasn't shot it very often. I don't think she shot it at all last year. Definitely hasn't shot it this year. Whew, it's been a while.
I gotta also say, just for speaking for everybody, oh my goodness, like go to the show notes and have a look at the pictures David provided. And the, I gotta say the bolt, the bolt over round, or base over bolt is how he's got listed at, jam. God, that just makes my teeth itch. That is just unpleasant to look at.
Hey, yeah, that's, I don't really know how to describe it, but it's one of those, on the one hand, I want to make a meme out of it, subtitled Mistakes Were Made, but I feel that that in itself is not sufficient.
I got to think about something about Mary. How'd you get the beans above the Frank?
Oh,
oh boy, that's just a miserable day right there at the range. I actually, what popped into my head when he was talking about clearing it was I was hanging out in an IRC channel, and there was a bunch of people that were not gun people, but were working on making they were coding a first person shooter, and they were now talking to me about the hey. Like, you know guns. What would this do, and how would this work, and all of that? And I was actually talking about the fact that, you know what, one thing they never do in gun games is have there be malfunctions. And it's one of those, like, especially when you look at, like, come on, when you're playing, like, you're shooting hundreds of rounds in rapid succession in odd positions and all that. You're going to get a mal from time to time. It's going to happen. It's probability. At least a bad primer. And, they were talking about, like, oh, you know, what happens if you get a jam? And one of the guy goes, oh, yeah, you just have to throw the gun away. And I went, no. You can fix it. Somewhere in the 80s, I always heard a lot of people talking about, like, I remember hearing, like, an interview when the Iceman killer was caught. And he talked about shooting somebody and it wasn't enough to finish him off, but he said the gun jammed, and so the guy just had to expire on his own time. And I'm just like, after I started shooting, I was just like, wait a second, what kind of a jam did he have that he couldn't clear it? So yeah, but if it was this jam, yeah.
So I actually remember a video game that had jams, and it was early aughts, and it was actually created and released by the Army. I think that they were using the Unreal Engine, and they made a simulator, and it was, okay, kids, here's a free shooter video game, but it was also used as a recruiting tool, and I don't know if they were M16s or M4 carbines or what they were at the time, but every so often, your firearm would malfunction, and you would have to press a specific key, and it would perform the sports drill. Now, you don't know what that means, but for all the military people, they all know what that acronym stands for. And let me see if I can do this. Slap the magazine in the well, pull the charging handle, observe the ejection port, release the handle, tap the forward assist, squeeze the trigger. And I saw it animated, and it was like, holy crap, they actually went through all the steps of sports. That's cool. But that's the only time I've ever seen any sort of jammer malfunction in a first-person shooter.
Yeah, but it's one of those, you're playing a video game. Imagine a video game where you're just sitting there at the bench cleaning the gun. Well, you shot it a whole bunch of times. You really need to clean this thing out. Use the analog stick to center the cleaning rod with the bore.
So speaking of cleaning rods, David said this, but he didn't explain why. So when you have a round that is not ejecting, he said to use your range rod to dislodge it and not to use a cleaning rod. But he didn't say why you shouldn't use a cleaning rod. So weird. Why shouldn't you use a cleaning rod to dislodge a stuck round?
Because a cleaning rod is very, very narrow and just designed to push a patch through the bore or run a brush through the bore. A range rod is almost the exact caliber of your bore, so it adds ample amounts of support and does not have it's more rigid than a cleaning rod. You don't want to get a cleaning rod in there, because if you're pounding on a, like, your standard brass cleaning rod, it could bow and actually nick the inside of your barrel and cause accuracy issues and damage to the gun.
Oh, well, good to know then.
And it might not work either. I mean, it's a good idea just to have something as big a stick as you can stick into the barrel to knock something out, because it just gives so much more support. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, and the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
It's almost 45 minutes, and I've only got a few seconds, so you can find me at Aaron Paulette on Facebook. Thanks to Nate Smith for music. Good night, everybody.
Good night.